This is the Grassy Knoll for February 6th, 2007. I'm having on the Informer for two 40 to 45 minute segments. The first will air today, the second on Thursday, and this was pre-recorded last week. The reason I asked for him to come back on was because of an email he sent around a few weeks ago addressing the War Powers Act and the latitude it gives the president and the manner in which it changes a government's attitude toward its citizens. One of the things that the contents of the email made me wonder about, and this is just one issue, was why we haven't had Congress declare war since World War II. And then I started to wonder, have we been in perpetual war? As to the question of whether we've been scammed about the Founding Fathers, the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, well, listen to what the I-Man has to say. Take down his references and cites and go look for yourself. You know, he does the research that nobody really wants to do because it's laborious. You deal with a lot of legalese, and it's just not the sexy stuff. But it's the stuff upon which this whole country of ours has been based. And now if we've been scammed by the lawyers, and that's the one thing that he said, too. You know, I asked him in past conversations, how in the world did some of the framers protest against the Constitution and sell out? I mean, some of them wanted the Articles of Confederation. I mean, why did they cave? And he looked at me and said, because they're lawyers. You know, and it made me think that, you know, maybe our framers or our founding fathers, whatever you want to call them, were less Christians and more Masonic and more lawyers than Masonic. And that's just as bad in a sense. So I think it's interesting stuff. And again, you know, take down whatever he says. I mean, take down the references. Take down the cites. And I mean C-I-T-E-S, cites. And look for yourself. You can go also to the website, atgpress.com, and then you'll see a link for The Informer. And there's another interesting gentleman there, too, by the name of James Montgomery, and they are known to one another, also has some very interesting information. And the reason, I mean, you have to find out for yourself. I mean, if you're not going to go and look at what information he presents, then you can't say he's bogus. And that's what everybody does, it seems, even on the Patriot side of the street. If they don't want to agree with it, they don't check it out. And so, yes, you can hang on to your delusions. And I think if you check it out, as I have, I mean, it's pretty hard to argue with. So by all means, check out what work he's done on atgpress.com. Now, I've done something else, too. If you go to the audio, and we do have the Patriot Games audio from Friday that we got up late, but there also will be the six-part series that The Informer and I did starting back last May. So I put it there only because if there's other further questions, you might want to listen to the other 6 hours, and they're there for, you know, your listening pleasure when you get around to it. But it'll also give you a better idea and background for what he's going to speak to in particular in these two segments. And as I said, they're heavily balanced, if you will, toward War Powers Act. And in the second segment, we go a little bit further on, for sure. But like I said, this to me pretty much nails it. And if it has been a scam, it's been a scam. I mean, they're governments. What are you going to do about it? You know, that's the way it goes. As Maureen Heaton said, and I think you might want to check out the late Maureen Heaton's PDF book. She never got it published. Nobody would probably do it anyway, but she died, I believe, also. It's on the website of Charlotte Iserbit. That website is deliberatedumbingdown.com. Look under education. Scroll down. Oh, let me see now. You know what? It's on the companion site. If you go to deliberatedumbingdown.com and then go down to the companion site, that'll lead you to Maureen Heaton's 356-page PDF. She calls it The Impossible Dream. What it's about is how the foundations changed America. That was your government, folks, and it always has been since the 20s. But what she said is, you know, we've been reluctant to criticize the United States because for the most part we've had a decent standard of living. Not all of us, of course. But that's kept us more or less from being critical. But the point is, have we ever really had a government, especially in the 20th century, that was benign to us, and have we ever had one at all?
We have back with us the I-Man. Hasn't been on for quite some time. He is the informer, as he's known, on the website that you can find very easily by typing in ATGPress.com. That stands for Against the Grain. He did a series with us once upon a time. He continues to pass around emails of information and also exchanges with others of like mind. And it's something that he sent me, I guess, a little longer than I really think it was. But I've been persistent in asking him to come on to address this because I think it explains a lot about what is happening today with military, with the president, and maybe even the Congress, too. So, I-Man, I know you had a little sticky going there health-wise. You're fully repaired and ready to go.
Yep, so far.
But the interview's not over yet.
Right.
Okay, now, you sent an email around, I think, at that time, from the very beginning of this whole subject, had to do, I think, what was it, with Washington and the War Powers Act? Do you remember back that far?
Oh, yeah, that was General Washington, well, President Washington, general at the time. And he instituted the first War Powers Clauses of the Constitution in order to bring in the first Bank of the United States, which was totally written against and wasn't supposed to be allowed. And because he knew that, and he was tied in with Hamilton real well, listened to Hamilton a lot, and didn't listen to Congress as much as he should have, and he decided that he would institute and use the War Powers Act that would allow him to bring in the first bank of the United States, which was foreign-owned, foreign-controlled,
right.
And under the behest of Hamilton. And that is where, in 1792, Montgomery has got the actual letters that he got from the Library of Congress, I believe.
You're referring to James Montgomery, right?
James Montgomery,
an associate of yours, yep.
And in there, he got some old newspaper articles back in the 1790s that said by the editors that we have lost our republic, and if we don't turn it around, we won't have any. And this is 1792, and it was because of Washington instituting the War Powers to bring in the first bank, which was forbidden by the Constitution.
All right, in an outline form, I mean, I don't mean to get you going completely down a road there,
yeah.
But
that's what started the genesis for all the presidents since then to be able to latch on to the War Powers Act and circumvent Congress.
All right, but I'm wondering, what is the tendon between the War Powers Act and the Bank of England? That sounds like it's disparate. How did the one allow the other?
Okay, the Bank of England, they never got into the first bank. Hamilton was set up because of his father. Actually, his name was Levine, and when he moved to the island of Nueves, he married Rachel, I think it was Welsh, but anyway, she was a mulatto, and he was then a black Jew, and that's why Aaron Burr had to battle the gun battle, because he slapped him and called him a black Jew and chided him every time he had a chance in Congress. And, of course, he didn't like it. So, but he was set up. By the time he was 15, he went back to England and was gleaned and taught by, you know, the powers back there, which was the bank.
Would that be the Rothschilds?
Yeah. And because his father was a friend of the Rothschild. And so when he came to the United States, he had everything in his possession that he was to be elected as the Secretary of Treasury, and therefore he was instrumental in bringing in the first bank. But a little thing happened is they didn't allow the Rothschilds or the Bank of England to actually become the bank. It was other bankers who was German descent, Swedish descent, French, you know, a whole bunch of different ones of the bank, but not the Bank of England itself.
So are you saying agents for the bank?
Yes, agents for the bank. And there wasn't enough agents for the Bank of England on the board that they could sway it so that they got in as the first bank. And that's why Hamilton cheated and embezzled. The first bank with so much money that, you know, that's why it went under. And then the second bank was reinstituted. And, of course, only lasted for a little while.
Right.
And then all the wildcat banks in the 1830s, you know, it was just wildcat banks, and that's right. And they destroyed most of the states and Congress all their money, and that's why in 1841, when the right before 1841, they instituted the independent treasury, which all the states and the United States put their money into. And that was a good bank because it dealt in specie only. It was no paper, no nothing like that. And then, of course, in 1841, the Whigs come into power, and they disbanded that. And then they were kicked out in 1845, and it was reinstituted as the independent sub-treasury, they called it.
And
that lasted all the way up until 1913, when Wilson and them bought in the Federal Reserve. Now, here's the Bank of England. See, they've been working. See, these people, they work and look 100 years down the road.
They
don't look like most Americans to the end of their nose, and that's as far as they can see.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were planning all along. They planned this all along and finally got what they wanted, because actually the Federal Reserve banks, the Federal Reserve, actually issued Federal Reserve notes in the 1890s. People don't know this. Only people like us that are nuts and spend hours in the library researching mundane stuff find this stuff out. But they actually circulated Federal Reserve notes in 1892, 1893, 94. And then in the 1900s, that's when they had enough power that they came in and they were side by side with the independent treasury. And then in 1921, by the Act of 1920, it's not the year 1920, but by the Act of 1920, eliminated the sub-treasuries, instituted the Federal Reserve Bank as the fiscal agent of the United States government, and then all the people who were in the sub-independent treasuries and the Secretary of Treasury and everybody there, they became the General Accounting Office.
GAO.
GAO is. And they were all ex-Treasury people. So, and that's what happened. But that was instituted by Washington, and then Lincoln instituted the war powers and used it fully, and so did Roosevelt. And every president since then has been operating under the Emergency War Powers Act.
Well, I got to take you back.
In other words, they've never been disbanded.
Banded, right. Well, I got to take you back real quick, if you mind. And,
sure,
and you don't have to dwell on it, but I didn't hear the third central bank that supposedly old Hickory killed.
Oh, you mean Jackson?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. When they wanted to redo their charter, that's when he knocked it out.
All right, so was there actually a third that finally reached its period of duration and wasn't renewed, or was a third never allowed?
No, the third was never allowed.
The
second was coming up for renewal, and this actually was the second bank on renewal, which would have been the third bank. Well, really, it's still the second, but this is why he killed it.
All right. Also, the Bank of England is a Rothschild bank. Would you call that the preeminent bank today of the world?
Yeah.
And it was back then for sure.
It was back. Oh, yeah, because that was in the City of London, which was separate. It wasn't anything to do with England itself. It was called the Bank of England, just like the first bank of the United States was a foreign controlled by all foreign people. But yet it was called the first bank of the United States. So everybody's saying, oh, well, it's the United States Bank. It's the first bank. No, it wasn't. It was the first bank in the United States, not of the United States.
Okay. So the United States quotes, and we're on the same page with this, that we, quote, win the American Revolution. All I can see is that the King of England recognized the states.
Well, that's all he did. We didn't really win it.
No.
Not like a war that you would win, like we won the Second World War and the First World War. We didn't really win the First World War, but the Second we did. And all the other wars after that has just been military skirmishes. They've been police actions. It's not a real war.
Right.
And there's one thing that most people don't realize. Under the War Powers Act, Congress does not have to have a declaration of war.
Right, right.
But did you know that any war to be eliminated, extinguished, has to be by treaty?
Well,
that's the only way a war, in other words, a treaty of peace is the only way. Now, I'm going to read you verbatim out of a book that I just got called War Powers of the Executive of the United States. And all the way back on page 267, it says, in the fourth place, the president as commander-in-chief determines when and upon what conditions hostilities are to cease. Didn't say anything about Congress.
No.
And since, there's a semicolon, and since a treaty of peace is the only constitutional method provided for terminating a war on the part of the United States, comma, he may also, comma, by virtue of his treaty-making powers, very largely determine the definitive conditions of peace and the time for the final termination of the state of war.
Would that also mean that there really, I mean, there really weren't any treaties that ended the Vietnam War, were they? Or
no, there Gulf were no treaties.
So the president decides the hostilities are over, and that's it.
Yeah, that's it. And it said another thing that most people I've been seeing on the internet lately about the habeas corpus.
Mm-hmm.
Never was a right. It was always a privilege.
Privilege, yep.
Because the Constitution, remember, never gave anybody any rights. I would say any of your listeners, read the Constitution, pick out what rights are enumerated, and tell them to you.
Well, they would say to you the Bill of Rights.
The Bill of Rights is not enumerated because it was only for the United States and it wasn't for anybody in the states of the Union. And the case of that, which I mentioned before, was John Barron.
Right.
Versus the mayor and city of Baltimore, where the Supreme Court came out and said unequivocally, and it's never been overturned, that the Bill of Rights was not for the people nor the states. They were for those 207 inhabitants of Washington, D.C., and the garbage that are controlling it down here now.
All right, so, and that's where we once spoke about when they refer to the United States of America, they're referring to whom?
The corporation of the crown called the United States. It's a subdivision of the British crown.
And so those are also the ones you're talking about who were covered by the Bill of Rights?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. And because in here, in this book, under the War Powers of the Executive of the United States, under Powers of Police Control, on page 191, it says, in March 1863, Congress expressly authorized the president to suspend the writ of habeas corpus and legalize his past acts. But for 2 years, Lincoln had suspended the writ of his own accord and had made arrests without warrant, holding the suspects as long as he pleased, not only with the without express authority and contrary to the prevailing opinion of his power up to the time of the Civil War, but in direct opposition to the authoritative ruling of Chief Justice Taney. So they say they can do whatever they want. Bush can do whatever he wants. Congress has nothing to say about it.
Well, in courts, lower courts, it does seem like habeas corpus, it does apply. I mean,
right.
Because it, obviously there is a charge laid and such.
Yeah, because see what it says, if you read the Constitution, it says the privilege and immunities, right? Everybody that joins has privileges and immunities. They have no rights. And if you read the section on habeas corpus, it says the privilege of the writ of habeas corpus. Now, there's the word. It doesn't say the right of the writ of habeas corpus. It says the privilege. Therefore, it was given to the people through the Constitution as a privilege and never was a right.
Can a privilege be revoked?
Sure.
Unlike a right, so to speak?
That's right.
Okay.
That's why they suspended the writ. They did it in 1863, and they did it all throughout the other parts. And in fact, the reason why the war powers is there, just think about this. When Johnson took over after Lincoln was killed, he was ready to eliminate the War Powers Act and put the country back into a peacetime organization.
Hence his defilement and threatened impeachment.
Now, here's what happened. In the Reconstruction Act, Congress realized all the power that they could have if they allowed the war powers to stand against even the president. And that is actually, the Congress is using the war powers when they're dictating to the states and everybody else in the country. In other words, it's conquest, mm-hmm. pure, simple conquest. And Montgomery had it on his website, on ATG Press also, when people read that, and you can see very clearly, and he's got that documented to the nth degree, that Congress is controlling everything, and that all the way up to 1959, the rent controls put in by the World War II Act still existed, and when they were taken to court in North Carolina, we found out in the archive building, they said that those rent controls could not be eliminated because they still are operating under the War Powers Act.
That's rich. Holy mackerel.
And you can actually go on there and read that whole taped conversation on ATG Press under the Informer under mythology, and there's a bunch of BS and all that.
Okay.
You know, in other words, when they went down to look at all the patriot mythology that's going around and all the BS that's being blathered about and people don't realize it, we wanted to find out, what are we dealing with here? And we found out what we were dealing with. You know, it was simple conquest under war powers and where the people were made the enemy of the United States. And of course, if anybody wants to pull it out, they can go and look at the 37th Congress, Session 1 of 1861, Chapter LX. It's called an act to confiscate property for the insurrectionary purposes. And it's exactly what Whiting used in his War Powers book to give the authority and tell the authority to the president that, hey, look, you can do this, you can do this, you can do this. And that's when they did it. And what it amounted to, it says, in Section 2, it says, and be further enacted that such prizes and capture, now that's admiralty,
mm-hmm.
shall be condemned district or circuit court of the United States, having jurisdiction in the amount or in admiralty, any district in which the same may be seized, or into which they may be first taken and first instituted. It's all admiralty terms. Now, when you come back down to the bottom, it says, and you got to think about this. Here's what it says. The words, quote, that the laws of the United States are opposed and the execution thereof obstructed, end quote, are self-evident that if you oppose the IRC, then you come under the War Powers Statute as an enemy having no rights because you are in resistance to the laws of the United States.
Okay.
And that's what it is. So, therefore, anybody that comes in under the War Powers and goes against any of the laws of the states and the United States, because we're all one happy family now, such as driver's license, property taxes, mm-hmm. Internal revenue, and all this, you are in opposition and resistance to the laws of the United States, and therefore, you are the enemy of the United States in an insurrectionary capacity.
Which has been with us for...
Since 1861.
Yeah.
In fact, it was since that one I sent you, which was the 37th Congress, Session 1, CA 6061, 1861, Chapter LX.
Two quick hits on what you've mentioned, and then I'll get back really, you know, to the threat of war powers. But I didn't want to let this go by since I got you. And that is, one, we can look at Hamilton pretty much as being treasonous, can't we?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he was treason when he first came in. I mean, that was his purpose.
And it's amazing, although I guess, well, maybe not so, that we would have him on a $10 bill and Franklin, who I don't think was a sterling character either,
right,
on a 50, both non-presidents.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, secondly, and this is probably showing to itself, but if you can tell me off the top of your head,
okay,
McKinley's assassination, was that based on finances? Was this a bimetal problem and such?
Yes. I didn't go too deep into it because I saw what was going on, and I had gotten in, you know, over where you first start. When you first start something, and you keep going and going.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I just jumped that about five times and found out what I wanted, and I just, you know, why read the rest of it? I know what the story was, you know? It's like when you read a court case, always go to the end, read the decision, and then go back and read the case, and now the case becomes so much clearer that you don't waste your time second-guessing of what they're trying to do and what they're saying.
Well, you know, I didn't understand what he might have done to run afoul of whatever parties, and we had Garfield assassinated not that long before.
Right.
And there's another whole mindset about that as well. We're certainly not looking at lone gunman nuts, although I think that's what they want us to believe, is it not?
Yeah, right.
Well, one of them was a lawyer, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. Most all of them are, yeah. Most all of them are lawyers because every governor except one in North Carolina was a lawyer. And the reason why they want lawyers in here is because of the bank, the Bar Association, the Middle Temples of the Crown.
Mm-hmm.
The Crown is not the king, but the Crown is the banking cartel that owned everything, that owned the Bank of England and everything else like that. In other words, they set up their attorneys, and if you read the book by Charles Warren on the history of the American bar, and in there you can see how when lawyers were so despised that Virginia made it a hanging offense for anybody to practice law because the lawyers totally decimated Virginia. And then after that, they got into good graces right before the Revolutionary War, and that's when Warren gave you the whole history of all the bar from before the war all the way up to 1920.
But, I mean, I'm right in saying one of the two assassins, I mean, we had what? We had Gateau and we had Czolgosz.
Uh-huh.
One of them was a lawyer.
Right.
And that was what? Was it Czolgosz, do you remember? Or you saying that Gateau was too?
I believe it was.
Okay.
Yeah. Because Livingston, remember when the Batcher cases in 1803, when Jefferson was claiming some of the Batcher cases, the property in Louisiana, and that was the land that was above water sometime and below water the other time. That's why they called it the Batcher cases. And okay, the lawyer that came over that defended him, they lasted until 1830, and the guy died. I mean, you know, they just kept putting lawyer after lawyer after lawyer on it.
Just to go ahead and obfuscate? And
yeah.
Okay. All right, so McKinley's assassination was...
was finance-oriented, yes.
Okay. All right.
I didn't go into the nitty-gritties and find everything, all of it.
No, but was this an affront to the Bank of England?
Sure.
Okay. No, because what we've been thinking about, when you think about the common threat through assassinations, one or two things happen, or they might be the same thing.
Uh-huh.
Usually you don't mess with the monetary system.
No.
And secondly, you usually don't mess with the Vatican.
Right, right.
Okay.
Well, that's why the Prussian, the guy in 1917, when he was assassinated because what he did.
Archduke Ferdinand?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, right there. Look how long they carried that. And because he was instrumental in some aspects of the Civil War because he was fronting the people, the money in the South, and he was against the United States for trying to, well, not the United States, but the people in power that wanted to separate and control the South, because the South had three times the amount of revenue generated by all all their shipping and trading than the northern states did.
Yeah.
And he was definitely with the French banks for the South because they were fronting all the money for the South.
Well, I may have confused the issue. The Archduke gets shot to start World War One.
Right.
Was he? Are you saying he was a personage at the time of the Civil War?
No, his father was.
Oh, his father was. I'm sorry. Okay.
And that's why they wiped out the whole family.
Oh, so
they eliminated the whole family. They didn't stop at just one guy. They went, you know, willy nilly. And 1917 is when him, his daughters, and his son, and his wife, they were all killed.
Do you know who wound up just surprising themselves by finding themselves the curator of the pistol that was used to kill the Archduke? Do you know what group has it?
No, I didn't get into
that. Jesuits.
Yeah. Yep. Because, like I said, when I read the parts on the Rothschild, on the book, it goes back into the Jesuits being sent over to the United States, well, to America, and to South America to stop any Republican form of government by being formed.
Right.
And that was their main problem because they didn't like republics. And, in fact, what's-name's book on that, which was Emmanuel Joseph's in the Federal Reserve Conspiracy in Rockefeller, the Gold Corner, he went back into great detail on this, on the Jesuits and the Vatican and how they were knocking apart all of the foundations of Republican form of government, and they were told to destroy it.
You have no argument. No argument here. The War Powers Act, going back, was that also, you know, this, you give us a different look at Washington. Some thought he was like the only last best guess, a chance we had.
Because, you know, Washington was just as bad because, remember, all the founding farters, I call them farters, they just blew ill gas. Anyway.
Okay.
Washington, when he came over here, remember, all these people, Franklin, Washington, and all those, they had money. They had land in Europe, the mother country, and they came over here. They didn't like what was going on. They wanted all the benefits, but they didn't want the taxes, so they revolted. Okay. And the king says, hey, we got the best navy in the world. We'll blockade you, and you'll bow down to us. And which they could. We had no navy.
Mm-hmm.
We had no army. They had all the navy ships and everything. You know, how else did we get here? So what they did, he gave an ultimatum. He says, I'll run a blockade on America. You won't get any shipping in or out. And I'll seize all your property over here, and you won't own a squat. And you'll be paupers in your colony over there.
Mm-hmm.
And they kowtowed. Because what happened was, remember, Washington was a real estate tycoon in 1853. And it was a Virginia land company that he worked for. And he was selling and making the killing on real estate over here by all the royalty that was coming over here to live and find land and whatnot.
Was it 1753, you said?
1753.
Right, okay.
Yeah, that's well known. You can go on and search Washington and what he did on the internet and find a lot of this stuff. You know, it's not just what I, you know, found in the library myself. Kind of, the internet came into effect.
Kind of like a version of Century 18 instead of Century 21.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Yeah. And he made a lot of money and everything. So, of course, they kowtowed and they said, okay, well, we'll set up your British colony. We'll be a subdivision, like Pontiac is a subdivision of GM.
Mm-hmm.
Just GM, that's the King of England. The United States is Pontiac, you know. It's a subdivision of the Crown. And basically, that's how it's looked at. And not by the average person today, you know, they think the Constitution is so wonderful a job and everything like that. But remember, the Constitution wasn't eliminated, wasn't destroyed. It just changed the venue to military into the War Powers Act, because when you read the War Powers Acts and you read Whiting on that, which is the top authority, bar none, he came out and said that, you know, the Constitution, it just lays aside its peacetime and goes into the wartime effect. And it's like night and day. But it isn't destroyed, it's just living under different principles based on war powers and based on peacetime.
Did war powers have anything to do with something that seems curious? I mean, you hear about this war of independence, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and not too long after, do you have the military turn upon the citizenry with the Whiskey Rebellion?
Oh, yeah, the Sedition Acts. That's what they did, you know. They turned around, and they wanted to protect the Crown's property and holdings here. And, you know, the people in power write the laws, they write history, they write everything. And what happened was, they, in the Whiskey Rebellion and everything, they didn't want to be taxed. Now, the shoe's on the other foot now, okay? Here you've got Washington and all these people who was against the king for all the stuff that was going on. And now you've got the people, the farmers in the Whiskey Rebellion against Washington. And in other words, Washington and them became England again.
Yep.
So then they said, well, we'll institute the Sedition Acts. And that's what they did. And they did that under the War Powers Act. And that's how they operated the Sedition Act.
All right, the Sedition Act, I think when it was last used, and you might, and you probably will upbraid me if I get this wrong, but I think was a case somewhere, what, around World War One. Was that Abrams versus Schenck?
It was, the speakeasy years.
Well, it was something where an individual was handing out tracts, if you will.
The what?
Tracts, or, you know.
Oh, the land.
Well, no. He was handing out propaganda.
Oh, okay.
During World War One. I don't know what, I'd have to go back to my law book, and the one I have. But what happened was, I think Oliver Wendell Holmes might have been the vote that swayed this case, and I think later on he lamented the fact that he did it. In other words, they did enact the Sedition Act against this individual for his utilization of free speech that was seen somewhat perilous at times of war.
Yeah.
All right. Now, are you familiar with that one at all?
Not really.
Okay.
I'd have to go back and research it again. I did read it, but, it just blew by my mind.
That's all right. No, and I mean, it's been a long time for me, too, but what did strike me was the fact that, you know, I'm surprised in a way that right now they haven't done that and said anybody who speaks against the government in this time, quote, of war, will be tried for sedition.
Well, they don't have to under the War Powers Act.
Okay, so, all right, great. That's germane also. Go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, they're one and the same, but they don't have to come out and say Sedition Act.
Okay, so in other words, when we look at the cases like with Juan Padilla, was it Juan Padilla? Yeah, Juan Padilla.
Mm-hmm.
Or Jose, or whatever.
Jose, yeah.
Jose, okay. The thing was, he's an American citizen and granted no privileges, I guess you would say.
Right.
Even though he's an American citizen locked up and nobody knows what's going on with him. And
that's right.
So in a way, that is a scene.
That's the elimination of the habeas.
Right.
The privilege of the habeas. That's why they can do what they do down in Guantanamo Bay, because it's actually a Sedition Act glossed over and prettied up to a different name.
And my point is that they never have to bring in the Sedition Act, which I've been waiting for them to kick back in. They don't have to. It's already here.
It's already here.
Okay. The other thing I would like to mention to you, I don't know if you've ever countenanced this, but there is a book that's written, and it's online. It's also in hardcover, that's called A Tort in an American Revolution. Does that ring a bell at all?
No.
All right. The author's name is Jerry Freesia, F-R-E-S-I-A. You can find that book online.
Okay.
Now, you may agree with what he states about the Constitution.
Uh-huh.
However, he isn't about Marxist, so we can't really go there either.
Right.
But what he says about the Constitution may, in fact, be very valid. And if there's ever a time you might want to look through there,
okay,
you can find it by just searching on those terms.
Okay.
And I've since talking to you and also in other areas, reading such, it seemed very much that the Constitution was almost like a unicorn. You know, very legendary, supposed to be a great thing, but in essence, it was an elitist document.
Yes, it was.
And that's because the lawyers took care of themselves.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
All right, going back to the War Powers Act and how as it impacts us now, and the reason why I contacted you, because suddenly, you know, to me, I got the V8 slap upside the head, and I said, could this be, this War Powers never really being revoked, the reason why from the days of the Korean War, we've never had anything that has been congressionally proclaimed a war, and yet we call them wars from Korea right to now. Now, is there a connectivity there?
Yeah, because I'm going to read you page 189 of the Police Power on the Executive War Powers. Although the Constitution itself does not expressly state by what authority the privilege of a writ, may be suspended, it had been a general opinion up to the time of the Civil War that Congress alone, not the President now, Congress alone had the power to judge of the exigency requiring that action. The opinion had been induced not only by the position of a habeas corpus clause that the part of the Constitution devoted to the legislative department, but also by precedent, by the precise practice under the Constitution, and by the weight of authority. And a footnote at 29, which was Ex parte Bowman, 1807, Story Commentaries on the Constitution. And what they had done is the War Powers comes under Article 1, Section 9, Clause 2. There's a bunch of them in there.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the one of them, and that falls right into what you were talking about.
All right, so therefore, we have been officially...
under war, never been out of the peacetime operation of the Constitution since 1863.
Well, we did declare war in 1 and 2 by Congress.
Right. Congress declared that, yeah.
All right, so when we look at that, they're just playing according to Hoyle?
That's all, yeah. Because remember, they overturned the president's wanting to abolish the War Powers Constitution and get back to a peacetime constitution after Lincoln was killed, and he says, "Oh no! We gotta have this. We gotta have this control. We gotta control the people, you know." And the problem is, when we're reconstructing everything, all the northern states are on the same footing as the southern states, so they're the enemy too.
Even the northern states?
All the northern states were, because remember, the Constitution in both wartime and peacetime says no state, they'll all be equal and have all equal footing. How can you create the southern states on a different footing under war powers on the north,
right,
under peacetime? You can't do that. So rather than take the 13 southern states and declare them, you know,
rogue or
out of the Union,
right. Mm-hmm.
Well, wait a minute. They said you can't destroy the Union and they can't leave, so now they're under control, and now anything in the Constitution is done, the northern states and the southern states has to be on the same footing, so they turned around and made every one of the northern states the same enemy as the southern states. And that was all done in the Reconstruction Acts, and that's why the War Powers Act still exists today, and people have no idea they're operating under war powers, and has ever since that 37th Congress put that into effect. 12 Stat 319.
I want to turn to...
I went and I asked many of the researchers that I knew at the time, do you know when they repealed 12 Stat 319? Of course, none of the top researchers that I had inquired about, this goes back like 15 years ago, not one of them said, yeah, da-da-da. Every one of them said, I don't know what you're talking about. They didn't even know 12 Stat 319 existed. So... I found it, but I had to work backwards. You can't work from the beginning. I couldn't find it. I had to work backwards from present day and follow the trail back to find out that 12 stat, and how I did it, I went to War Powers, Title 50, and I searched every title, every subchapter in there, and I found 212, 213 and 215. And at the bottom of those particular sections, it says source, 12 stat, 319. Then
okay.
I says, okay, if it's here, let me go to Title 28. So I went to Title 28, And I went to 2460, 2461, 24, all the way up to 2465. And every one of them had the source of that authority for that statute, 12 Stat 319, 1861. It took me a year to do that. Because there was no library. I went to the library. There was no... I didn't have any computer at that time.
Would that be more easily accessible by the computer, or is that a gone down the memory hole?
No. You can go online, and you can go into Title 50 now and go to 12 Stat. I mean, not 12 Stat. Title 50, go to Chapter 215, 213, and 212, and you go all the way down to the bottom, you'll see it, and you'll see the source of the statute that exists today in Title 50 under War Powers, and you do the same thing under Title 28, but you have to go backwards in it. It doesn't. Title 50 does, but the 28, you have to wrangle around to find it, and it's there.
This program is produced by Visigoth Incorporated. Any rebroadcast or use of this program without the express consent of Visigoth Incorporated is strictly encouraged. I'm Phil McCracken, the voice behind the voice, and thank you for listening.